We're talking about the boom, fracking. It's the book by Russell Gold. He is a senior energy reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And we will be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about fracking and how he believes it has ignited the American energy revolution and changed the world. We'll be back. Welcome back. Russell Gold with us. So, Russell, were you a fan of fracking before you wrote the boom, or did the writing of the book turned you into a fan of fracking?
Well, I went on my first frack job, you know, the first hand, went out there and watched it in 2003. So, I mean, I saw the industry kind of grow up, you know, doing this. And I just, it wasn't something that I saw as particularly controversial. Now, I had my eyes open about some stuff, some corners that were being cut, some improvements that needed to be made. So I'm not sure I would say I was a fan of it. I recognized its value and what it was doing. And I just saw it differently than other people.
If you had to put a percent on it in terms of what percent has fracking contributed to additional oil and gas, well, what would you say? I mean, it may be a guess.
In the United States?
Yeah.
In the United States, you know, 90% plus
increase.
If it weren't, if it weren't for fracking, the United States has added just enormous amounts of oil. We are up 2 million barrels a day from where we were a day, and that's all fracking. It's not the Gulf of Mexico. It's not. I mean, Alaska just keeps shrinking and shrinking. It is all. It's all these new wells. No question about that.
Who invented it? How did this happen?
Well, you know, like much else with fracking, that's controversial. You know, the anti-frack activists will say, well, this is a new technology and it's untested. And, well, there's something to be said. That's kind of true. And the industry recently sent around a happy 65th birthday to fracking, and that's kind of true, too. I trace it all the way back to the very beginning, the very earliest days of the oil industry back in the 1860s when Colonel Drake was out in western Pennsylvania drilling those first wells. And just a couple of years after those first wells in Pennsylvania, another guy shows up in town, and he's got what he calls the Roberts torpedo. And what it is it's an explosive device that he's going to put at the bottom of the well. He covers up with water and ignites the torpedo, and the weight of the water forces the explosion out into the rock, and that's you know, he starts doing that, and he's incredibly successful, and he creates fractures. That's what his patent says. I'm trying to create fractures in the rock. And you know, this is all but forgotten, because a couple decades later, down in Texas and out in California, they find these gushers, you know, these enormous oil fields, and you no longer have to blow up the rock to try to get them to work. And so we sort of forget about fracking for a while, and it's right after World War II that we've started, once again, the United States is kind of beginning to think, we're running a little short of oil, and where are we going to get it from? And there's some researchers in Tulsa, Oklahoma, working for an old descendant of the Standard Oil Group. And they're looking at it, and they're testing out cement. And they realize that sometimes when they're cementing the outside of oil wells, they lose some of that cement. Where's that cement going?
Mm-hmm.
And they came up with this hypothesis that, in fact, the weight of the cement is causing a fracture, is causing some of these rocks to break. And this was sandstone. This wasn't the really dense shale. This was much more
porous
rock.
This stuff could brittle your break with your hands.
But they figured it out, and they said, well, wait a second. What if we try to do that instead of accidentally fracturing rock with cement? What if we tried to do that with water? And so they look around and they say, okay, we got to slick in the water with something. And there was a lot of leftover napalm, believe it or not, from World War II. So they slickened it with some napalm and they put it down into the well. And the first few attempts were mildly successful, but eventually they get it going and they realize that these are small frack jobs. It's not, you know, not much water, not much pressure, nothing like what we do today. What we're doing today is 10, 20, 30 times more powerful. But they would do small frack jobs, and what's amazing is that they call it the hydrofrack treatment. It's so popular. You read the literature from the 1950s, and the petroleum technology magazines at one point named this the invention of the year, and there were thousands of the wells being treated like this. And so, you know, it really comes after World War II, but then there's another enormous breakthrough, and it involves one of the more fascinating people of the 20th century, a guy named George Mitchell, son of Greek immigrants, grew up very poor in Galveston, mm-hmm. Texas, ends up going to Texas A&M, studies, and sets off on his own, and he sets up shop as an oil man in Houston, right in the late 40s, and he is one of the first. He's really part of the first generation that is moving away from drilling wells by their gut instinct and trying to use science.
Yeah.
And so he goes out there and he decides that he's going to, you know, he uses science, he gets some wells, and eventually he leases this incredibly large gas field north of Fort Worth. And for years and years, that you know, makes him a millionaire. And then his mind starts to wander, and he gets interested in sustainability, and he meets Buckminster Fuller, and he falls under the sway of Buckminster Fuller, and he funds lots of work in investigations and sustainability and how do we live on this spaceship Earth. He's really interested in that and depleting resources. But at the same time, he realizes that his bread and butter, this gas field north of Fort Worth, is running out. And he says to his people, you know, every time we drill in this gas field, we drill shallow wells, we get some gas, but when we drill a little deeper, we're always going through the shale. And our instruments tell us there's just little bits of gas we're seeing there. Can we figure out how to get the gas out of that shale? And what's amazing is that for 16 years, he tells his people, drill a few wells a year, fail, try something different. Try different ways to do it. Don't worry about failing. Just do it. And for 16 years, he keeps at it. I mean, can you imagine a company these days, a big company, which says, you know what, just fail for 15 years. It's all right.
That's unheard of. That would never happen today.
But it did, because he was stubborn, and he was a scientist, and he believed, well, he had a scientific bent. And in 1998, and this is a story I tell, many of these stories I tell in my book, and we've been talking a lot about policy and is it safe, is it not, but you know, a lot of the book is really about the stories of the people involved in this, because that, I think, is just the most fascinating. There's this young engineer who, you know, he's driving an old beat-up car, he's worried he's going to get fired, and he goes to his bosses and says, you know, I've got this new idea, new idea of how we might be able to get the shale to crack. And, you know, he had heard from some buddies about some fracking in some of these porous rocks to the east. He says, why don't we just try, you know, let's supersize it. You know, maybe the problem is that we just haven't gone all in yet. You know, let's try to frack these, you know, let's try to frack the shale, but instead of using, you know, a lot of chemically goop, let's just use mostly water. But let's use a lot of it. And, you know, he gets permission to try some three wells, and wouldn't you know it, the first three wells are all messed up. Too much sand, he clogs up the well. So he goes back and says, you know, I want permission to do three more. And the fourth one is a failure. And the fifth one, in the summer of 1998, he finally gets all this water down into the well. The well swallows the water, and he doesn't know what's going to happen. Slowly they pull out the water. And when that well comes on, it is the best well that they've ever had in years. And I mean, not even close. They had figured out they had fractured the shale. And it was the first time. And then, you know, that's really, the world pivoted that day. And from then on, it really is the beginning of abundance of energy. And it's this amazing story how in the United States we go from having not enough energy and importing it from around the world to suddenly having an abundance of energy. And it was all because of, you know, a company and an engineer who just said, you know what, we're just going to keep trying amazing different stuff until we figure it out.
Why doesn't wind power and solar power catch on?
I actually think they are catching on.
I don't know.
You look at the numbers, 10% growth year after year, double-digit growth. It's a phenomenally quick growth.
In what, solar
the
or
other
wind?
Day, both. The other day, let's see, it was about 3 weeks ago, the Texas power grid, ERCOT, the power grid that does almost all of Texas, had 29% wind. It was for 1 hour, it was a record.
Yeah.
For 1 hour. But still, think about that. Texas is not, you know, this is not some rinky-dink power grid. This is a major power grid with lots of industrial users. 29% of it was from the wind. Solar is growing. You know, the prices of solar keep coming down, and it's very efficient. I think wind and solar have a great future. The problem with wind and solar is that we have built a power system that relies on resources that we can turn on and off when we need it.
That's right.
You know, coal plant, we need you to turn on next hour. Nuclear plant, we need this many megawatts of power from you. And wind and solar struggle that way. They're great sources of energy, and you know, they're a little bit more expensive, but they've got other benefits. But they're not controllable. They're not dispatchable. So the real struggle is, well, if we're going to bring in more and more oil, if we're going to bring in more and more wind and solar, we need something to balance. We need something out there that can balance these resources. And that's really where natural gas is going to play a huge role into the future, I think, because natural gas is the perfect way to balance it.
Do you think most homes in America should have solar panels on the roofs?
Not right now, just because it's a cost issue. But I think eventually, sure. Look, this is free energy. You can put a couple panels on your roof and get free energy. Why not? Makes perfect sense to me. We're going to have to figure out a way to keep the grid going, even if we're only going to be using it for parts of the day. That's going to be tricky. Balancing the grid is going to be tricky. But why not? What's wrong with basically free energy? Now, right now, solar costs a lot. No question about that. But think about this, that natural gas and oil and coal, prices of them can fluctuate, and that can really hurt the economy. You never know if natural gas is going to be cheap or expensive. Once you put wind and solar up, they're more expensive, but once you put them up, you know what the cost of fuel is going to be. It's zero. So it's a little bit more, you can plan around it. And that's a whole different way of approaching this. I think the future of renewables are actually very big and very strong.
Do the Saudis frack their oil wells?
No, they don't need to.
Why?
They still have these great oil wells. Because they've got these great oil wells that just flow freely. I mean, think about the pictures you may have seen of
Wouldn't they get more,
right?
Though?
What was that?
When they get more out of their oil wells?
Here's the problem with that, right? Okay, no, I have to think about it. That's a good question. I have to think about it for a second. These wells, the really great oil fields, and let's face it, fracking is not great. It doesn't create great oil fields. You have to work hard to get the oil out. But the great oil fields are under so much pressure that the oil flows up on its own. Well, if you have, a field like that, your biggest concern is going to be just making sure you don't have a blowout, that the oil is not coming up so fast that you lose control of the well. The last thing, you don't have sort of a wide-open well that you can force water down. Your biggest concern is keeping the oil from coming up. So that's why I don't think fracking makes sense in the Saudi wells, because these are very active wells with a lot of pressure. Going back to the Deepwater Horizon, that was a well that was extraordinarily pressured, and they were doing everything they can to control it, and they lost control of it. And imagine in a well like that trying to force a few million gallons of water down it while the oil and gas is trying to come up it. Just not going to work.
48% yes in favor of fracking, 47% no. So my theory now, Russell, is that the more people understand fracking, the more it inches up as in favor of, and it's 50-50 all the way. What do you think?
No, I think that there's a lot of misinformation about fracking, and I'm not trying to say, and I certainly don't believe it's perfect. It's not. It's an industrial process, but it confers a lot of advantages. I think it has a lot of good advantages in energy, and as long as the companies and the communities and the regulators keep an eye on it or are vigilant to make sure it's being done right, I think there's a lot to be gained.
Is there a downside to fracking at all, in your opinion?
Well, I think one of the big downsides is that we found a lot more oil and gas, and that presents a big climate problem. We're going to use that oil and gas, and you know, there's a lot of concern about just how much carbon dioxide we're putting up into the atmosphere. But that said, I don't think renewables are quite ready for prime time. They're not ready for to supply 30% of our power on an ongoing basis or 40% of our power. So we've got to figure out a way to get there. And, you know, right now, fossil fuels are what we got.
Right now. That's absolutely right. Now, you've got a book tour coming. You're in Denver right now. Have you already had that tour?
I'm sort of in the middle of it. Yeah. San Francisco, New York, Washington, Houston yesterday, Denver today, going back to Austin tomorrow.
They can track you on your website for these events?
Yep. I put it on the website or follow me on Twitter. I'm announcing most of it on Twitter. So doing the social media. Come on out to see tomorrow in Austin. Got events next week in Dallas and Philadelphia. So I'll put those up on my website.
What do your peers, fellow writers, reporters think about the boom?
So far, some great reviews. I've been happiest that newspapers on all sides of the political spectrum seem to like it and seem to say, well, and have said it's the best book out there on energy, and you learn a lot. I mean, when the San Francisco Chronicle, you know, obviously in a very left-wing city, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, which, you know, is right in the heart of shale fracking country in Pennsylvania, when they both gush about the book, you know, it makes you feel good because it means that, you know, people are recognizing it for what it is, which is not... It doesn't take a strong position. What it is trying to do is sort of say, look, between the don't frack anywhere folks and the drill baby drill folks on one, you know, on the other side, that there's about 85% of us in the middle who say, you know what, this is important. We care about energy. We care about the environment. We care about living, and you know, we want to know more. We want to get away from some of this this yelling at each other and find out what's really going on, because we recognize that the energy boom is here and it's not going anywhere and it's really going to affect our lives, and I want to be educated about that.
That's right. Does the Block family still own the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, do you know?
You know, I don't know.
I think they do. I know them. I think they also own the Toledo Blade, old-time newspaper family.
Wow.
You don't have many of those anymore.
No. I used to work for one, and then they sold to Rupert Murdoch. But, you know, he's been a pretty good owner, too.
Yeah, he understands. He sure is very aggressive. But Wall Street Journal, of course, has got its thumb on the economy. What are they saying these days, Russell, about our economic future? Anything?
Well, we seem to be slow. This is about the slowest recovery I can ever think of. Things are getting better, but just so slowly. We were so, you know, the economy was so burned in 2008, 2009 that we just seem to have developed a pretty big case of not wanting to risk anything. So the economy is ever so slowly and gingerly improving, but not quickly enough for the thousands and tens of thousands of people who are amongst the long-term unemployed. And that, I think, is one of the, you know, we seem to have dug ourselves out of the real estate hole we created, and economy's growing a little, but the real persistent problem are people who lost their jobs and couldn't find other jobs and have just entered this long period of unemployment and have sort of become almost unemployable. You know, imagine trying to, in your 50s, being without a job for 2 or 3 years and going back and trying to explain the hole in your resume. That's a big problem, I think, and it's too bad. I don't see any solutions, and I'm not sure what to do about that.
All right, well, stay with us. We're going to come back and take some phone calls in a moment with Russell Gold as we talk about the boom. You know, the California Earthquake Authority, our great station in Los Angeles, KFI AM 640, the American Red Cross, are all joining forces to send an urgent message, and it is Get Prepared California. It's an initiative to prepare California in case of a damaging disaster. To raise money for this important cause, right now until Friday, April 25th, we are auctioning off dinner with a number of people, including me, at Morton's in Burbank, California, followed by a tour of the KFI studios. One pair of tickets goes to the highest bidder. How do you do this? Simply bid by going to KFIAM640.com. That's KFIAM640.com. In the search there, type in Red Cross, and then scroll all the way down until you see me, and then bid. And we've had a number of great winners who have bid over the last couple years, and we've all remained pretty close. So go ahead and do that. KFIAM640.com, search Red Cross, scroll down, and bid on me. And welcome back to Coast with Russell Gold, the Boom. We're going to start calls a little earlier because since a moment Russell's been on with us, the phones have not stopped ringing. So we're going to do that for you. The energy boom, is it a good or bad thing, Russell?
I think it's a good thing. You know, if you force me to choose, I think it's a good thing. Look, we're in the middle. We've been talking about being in the middle of an energy transition, you know, a need to change and move away from fossil fuels towards something else. And I would much rather be in the middle of a transition where we have abundant energy, we're not fighting over it, prices are relatively low, than the opposite. So if you twist my arm, voting good.
China has got all kinds of air pollution problems these days, and I think they're blaming its energy usage. Maybe coal, who knows what. Do you see a problem there because of this?
In China, I'm not sure I'm following you here.
Well, with pollution, I mean, they're suffocating.
Yes. Oh, yeah. No, it's without everything. I mean, I'm no China expert, but everything I read leads me to believe that China has got a whole bunch of bad options. You know, they're trying desperately to change their their energy mix because they not just have lots of pollution, but it's become a huge political liability for them. It's causing social unrest. They're in a really difficult position. And, you know, I don't think it's surprising that they're the world leaders right now in solar manufacturing. They're trying to figure out a way out of this because the status quo is just not working for them.
No, not at all. Do you ever find the point, Russell, where a nation is so dependent on outside sources of energy that wars will be created because of it? And I don't mean from us.
If you read books like The Prize, Dan Juergen's great history of energy, energy and maintaining energy is absolutely in the bottom of so much of what we do, so much of what happens in this world. So, yes, are wars fought over energy? Yeah, unfortunately, they are. There's no question.
All right, let's take some phone calls with you for the next hour and a half here. Let's go to Gary in Tampa, Florida. Welcome to the program. Gary, you're on the air with us.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
I wanted to make a couple of observations about the environmentalists because in about the last 2 years, I've done a lot of reading and educated myself on fracking, and I really believe that if these environmentalists that are so worried about pollution and other things would educate themselves, like the gentleman said, they would it becomes self-evident that fracking to get natural gas is what we need to do on so many fronts. First off, we need to supplant coal immediately. Coal is a nasty substance. It puts twice the amount of carbon dioxide into the air that we breathe, all kinds of chemicals that natural gas does not. And look what happened in North Carolina just a while back. Coal creates ash. They've got these huge mounds of coal ash, and one of them broke and seeped into the Dan River and fouled 70 miles of the Dan River. It's going to take years to clean this up. There's communities that use that river for drinking water, and now their water source is fouled. We're about 10, maybe 20 years away from having abundant, clean, renewable energy, whether it's solar, gas, dams, geothermic, and there's other exotic energy that Tesla talked about 100 years ago. The Earth is a huge magnet. We can get some low Earth orbit infrastructure, and as it orbits, it will cut the magnetic lines of force of the Earth, create abundant energy that can be beamed back down. that's probably a little further off. But certainly in the next 10 to 20 years, we will have a lot more clean, renewable energy just with solar, wind, geothermic, and dams. And so in that 10 to 20 years, natural gas is the best bridge to get us there. It's cleaner, it's abundant, and we won't have to import anything. We need to become energy self-sufficient. There is no reason for us to import any energy. In the first half of the 20th century, we didn't import any energy. We exported energy. We need to get back there. That will solve all kinds of political problems, economic problems, and natural gas, I think that your guests will agree, natural gas is the least polluting of the fossil fuels. We've tapped into an abundant source of it, and if the environmentalists would just educate themselves a little bit, like I said earlier, it would become self-evident that they need to embrace that, get away from coal, and get us to renewable energies in about 10 to 20 years. I just wanted to see what your guests think about that. Thanks a lot. Great.
You're very welcome. Go ahead, Russell. Let you react to his
thoughts.
Well,
he makes some great points there. One of the points he made that we hadn't talked about yet is when you burn coal, I mean, let's not even talk about about climate change, but you've got all sorts of pollutants, NOx and SOx and other things that make the air dirty.
Even with your scrubbers, you still get something, don't you?
Yes, you do. Yep. You know, coal's gotten cleaner, but natural gas is cleaner still. And so, no, I mean, I think what your caller says makes a lot of sense, and it's something that studying this is an opinion I've come around to, which is that when we have lots of natural gas, it is clearly better than coal. Coal plants have been shut down. The air is cleaner. There's just a lot of good stories going on right now, and sometimes they're overlooked by the fear of fracking. And, you know, look, fracking's not perfect. There are issues with it, but they're much more manageable than what we have right now.
And when they talk, Russell, about renewable energy, the renewables, what are the renewables?
Well, you've got, you know, your caller actually sort of named them very well. We've got hydroelectric dams, you know, the big dams out west and some smaller dams in the east. That's really good energy because you can, not just is it renewable, but you can store it. You know, when the water is behind the dam, you can choose when to release it and when to generate energy. You've got geothermal, which is tapping into the heat that exists far underground and using some of that heat to turn turbines. You've got wind and you've got solar. Wind is mostly big, you know, the big wind turbines you've seen pictures of. And solar kind of comes in two flavors, right? You've got solar panels on people's houses, what are called distributed generation. And then you have some giant projects out in the desert that, you know, where you have just acres upon acres of solar panels. So those are your four big ones, really. And then, you know, to a lesser extent, you have some renewable resources that have been attempted to go into the transportation fuel. Ethanol is probably the best known. Cellulosic ethanol was talked about. Biodiesel, that's been less successful.
Okay, let's go now to Greg driving in Michigan on a wildcard line. Hey, Greg, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Jordan? I appreciate you having me on the show.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Russell, you're doing a great job describing frack. I'm actually I actually work in North Dakota. I'm actually a frack mechanic. I actually work on location where I'm heading right now. And it's been a wonderful boom to the North Dakota economy. I mean, it's got its problems, but I mean, it's the best thing going right now. It seems to be the answer to the problem at the moment until we transition to something better.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that. Last time I was up in North Dakota, I was out on a rig near Killdeer, just a little north of Dickinson, and almost everyone I met there had a similar story. They all said, well, I was building houses, I was landscaping, I was doing custom kitchens. You know, they were involved in the great real estate boom, and that completely dried up. And these were people who, they were used to working outside and working hard physical labor, and They were, you know, just delighted that there were jobs for them up there in North Dakota, and fairly high paying jobs also.
Absolutely. I worked, I'm a mechanic out there, out in Williston, and the automotive industry here in Michigan kind of dried up, and that's where I went out west, and it's been really, it's just been a boom to my family, and, you know, it's working. I mean, there's a lot of guys out there, you know, working 100-hour weeks and, you know, making six-figure incomes, and, you know, it's just, it's the best thing going right now. I don't see why, I mean, and when you're describing the process, I mean, you kind of hit the nail on the head there. It's, you know, it's not perfect, but it seems to be getting the job done, you know, and just like that, everybody's afraid of the chemicals. We're pumping way more water and sand down the hole than chemicals. Like you said, they're bad chemicals. You don't want to drink them, but at the same time, you know, and the ratio of chemical to water is just, you know, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to how much water we're pumping down a hole.
1 or 2% by volume of what you're putting.
Yeah, it's not even that. And then go back on the environmental standard. You know, I work on these sites all the time. And we have to have everything in containment. If I spill more than 2 gallons of diesel fuel, chemical, whatever it is, I have to record it to the state. So, you know, there's a lot of regulation.
That's right.
And on a lot of guys, you know, when I park these pumps, these big pumps we're using are on, are on 18-wheelers, of course, you know. We got to park that whole truck in one containment. You know, you can't drop anything on the ground without the state knowing.
When you're running them, do you park them on, like, some tarp, some heavy-duty tarp, so that if something does spill, it's collected instead of running into the ground?
Yep. Basically, that's another thing, too. There's another industry set up there, these guys that build these containments for me to drive my trucks on. So there's a whole other industry that comes off of just that, just the environmental side of it. You know, guys cleaning up spills, if necessary, or, you know, building these containments.
You know, I'm so glad you called, because I think most listeners don't have an idea, but when they build this fracking operation, you know, they're bringing in dozens and dozens of trailers filled with water and sand, and then these giant pumps. And I don't even know how they do it, but they park these things so close together, you can't even put your hand in between. It is unbelievable what they can fit on a 1 or 2 acre pad. Someday you'll have to explain to me exactly how you position all those trucks in such a tight space, because it's pretty remarkable.
That sure is. Greg, thanks. I appreciate you being part of Coast to Coast and great comments there. Next up, we go to Sally in North Dakota. Sally, go ahead.
Hi, George. I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time.
Hello, Sally.
Russell Gold is on the show tonight, and he said that he has been in North Dakota and have seen what's going on with our oil industry here. And he actually did say that it went a little bit too fast, and they drilled, and then asked questions later. Well, he also said that the emissions are too high. He admitted that. Now, I'm going to say something. Russell, before I called, I voted no against fracking, but then the more I heard on the show tonight, I'm kind of changing my mind about that. I think fracking is probably okay.
And then, by the way, the no's are now winning again, by the way, by a few percent. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But one thing I really would like to say in the love of North Dakota, is that I do read a column every Sunday put out by a wonderful historian, Clay Jenkinson, who is, he's a Theodore Roosevelt Center scholar at Dickinson State University, and he's a scholar of the humanities in Bismarck State College, and he, too, does love our state. And he did say that he drove up, you know, the little Missouri road through Medora with some friends last weekend, and, you know, he said, where the rolling plains yield to the magnificent chasm of the Little Missouri River in what has been regarded as the most breathtaking scene of one of the most beautiful places in North Dakota, they went and built a salt, it's a salt, I guess, storage. You know, it's a gigantic.
What do they store?
A dozen large brown cylinder storage tanks and an array of dumping stations that look like a gigantic covered truck stop.
What do they put in the tanks? And,
well, I would imagine that they're dumping the reserve or the excess that runs off from their drilling, I would imagine, because it is a dumping site.
It could be an injection well site where a lot of the wastewater that comes back up, you truck in, you might store it, and then you inject it down into the ground.
I guess you got to put it somewhere, Russell, don't you?
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. Look, one of the things I keep hearing from people, and I think I'm hearing it from your listener as well, but I hear it from, you know, some of the folks in the industry and others that I talk to, is maybe we should have a conversation about how that there are certain places that are off limits to fracking and to industrial development. You know, that we haven't really had that conversation, and because fracking occurs so much, you know, there's so many well pads and so many wells that are drilled that it can just sort of take over a landscape. And maybe what we need to do is sort of say, okay, you know, in every landscape there's 25% of it or 10% of it, whatever it is, but there's just certain special areas that we should keep the way they are. We don't need to frack every acre. I'm hearing more people discuss that. Talk about that, and maybe the vista that the caller mentioned should have been one of those places. Maybe it's too late now, but I'm sure there are other places that might be protected, and I don't think that's unreasonable. We shouldn't turn over every square inch to fracking. You know, maybe that's part of the discussion that needs to happen.
Have there been protests near these drilling sites at all? Russell, are you still with us?
To me or to the caller?
To you.
Have there been protests? Oh, well, sure. Not so much near the drilling sites, but there have been protests. You know, whenever you have a process that with the word fracking, as you can imagine, the placards get quite entertaining and quite creative. But yes, no, absolutely. I was in Philadelphia for a conference, and the entire outside was a big protest rally. You know, people feel very passionate about that.
They are very passionate, very emotional on things like that. And the name of the book, The Boom, stick with us. We're going to come back for a final hour of phone calls with Russell Gold. His website, of course, is his name, russellgold.net. Linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com.